Session number 26947.
Mr. Jarvis, Reel 10. Now, we're talking about your time with as a pilot and then later flying instructor at RAF Hornchurch, 1947-1953. What was the setup of the training? How often would you have to report in? Or was it purely when you fancied it a weekend? What was the sort of way it was organised?
Well, you flew at weekends, generally, except during a fortnight's annual training where you had to be there full time, and obviously the training took place all the week.
But let's take this. What about the weekend flights? What would happen on a typical weekend flight? Or training session?
Well, you'd be detailed to do a certain thing, like fly a cross country flight, do some instrument flying, and generally do circuits and landers, general flying, literally keep your hand in all flying aspects.
And for how long?
Well, you probably would fly for about an hour, either Saturday or even Sunday. But the main point was you had to complete 40 flying hours a year. And provided you did the 40 hours any time during the year, you would have achieved what you're contracted to do.
And when you reported to Hornchurch, say, and to do a flight for an hour or so, what about the rest of it? Was that all you did? Turn up, fly and go? Or did you have any ground training or ground duties?
You had a certain amount of ground training to do, but it wasn't that intensive.
Now, what about the fortnight, the annual camp?
Well, that was much more intensive because then you had a lot more ground school training to do, and also quite a bit of flying, which you needed to do to achieve your 40 hours target.
And where would you go for your annual camp? Would you just go to Hornchurch?
Hornchurch, but occasionally you would go to places, I mean, friends like North Weald, airfield, which is not terribly far away, and occasionally we would be given the opportunity to go on to other aircraft for general flying experience. I mean, on one notable occasion, I remember I went there and was given the opportunity to fly a Meteor, a jet aircraft, the one and only time I ever did fly.
Had you had any previous, well, I mean, in the sense of how have they trained you to do it?
Because you've got
a conversion course.
For yeah, absolutely. But no, this was quite simple because flying jets is much easier, strange it may seem, than piston engine flying.
In what way?
Well, when you take off with a piston engine aircraft, depend upon the direction of the propeller, you have the torque effect, which tends to pull the aircraft to one side, and you have to correct that with your rudders. But with regard to a jet, and as I found this with a Meteor, there was a young flight lieutenant who was in the auxiliary squadron, and he said to me, right, it's all yours, take it away. And he said, all you need to do, which we did, put it in the middle of the runway and just open up the twin throttles. And it just went straight, and you could have taken your feet off the rudder bars. It went straight off and took off. And he said, right, carry on, come fly to 1,000 feet. And then he said, carry on flying, doing some medium turns, steep turns, etc. And I was amazed. It was the simplicity itself, jet flying.
What about the speed? Was it
much faster? Faster.
Was there a perspective in that made it more difficult?
Not really, unless you're near the ground. You're not really aware of difference in speed unless you get really near the ground.
And what about landing it?
I wouldn't let me do that. No, he just simply let me do some flying, and then he took it over, and then he landed.
That explains a lot to me. You were. I mean, that because that would need some more experience.
Of course, you would. You have to be trained. It wouldn't take long to actually learn to land a Meteor, but obviously I was not qualified and was not in a position to be allowed to land a Meteor, no.
Now, any other interesting aircraft you flew?
No, they were the only ones.
Now, what about your training as a flying instructor? Were you qualified?
I did, actually.
Now, what training did you have for it?
Well, again, these were on chipmunks. It comprised 18 months. And there are 10 of us, actually, were offered to take the flying instructor's course. And I was able to accept it because I was with the Port of London Authority, obviously, as a civilian. And I managed to take the course for 18 months and eventually qualified. But of the 10, there were only 6 actually that completed the course, because 2 of them, strange it may seem, were killed here in Billericay, low-flying and hit a tree. And 2 others couldn't continue because of the requirements of their civilian employment.
Now, were you a flying instructor just for the chipmunk, or were you...
Yeah, just for the chipmunk. Mm.
And so how did you find flying instructing? I mean, you know, what was it like?
Obviously different from general flying, yeah.
Had it changed much from when you were a lad, so to speak?
Yeah.
I mean, what were the processes quickly of training a pupil? And...
Well, it's very simple. You went with another trainee instructor. After obviously you've been explained by a proper flying instructor what you needed to do, but it mostly comprised of what we called patter practice. That patter practice, that simply means that you, on one occasion, would perform the role of the instructor, and you'd be with another a trainee who would then would fly the aeroplane, and you'd tell him what to do and correct him if he made any errors. That was the idea. And then you'd swap roles, you know, you'd land and swap roles and carry on that way.
Now, what I meant was, though, as well, how did you train when you were qualified? How did you? What was the process of training a pupil? What was the, you know?
Well, I didn't really have the opportunity to literally train pupils. I was trained as a flying instructor, but I did periodically afterwards take air training corps cadets up, and I then gave them certain flying instruction, and some of them were very good actually. But I was not allowed to let them go solo. And that really was as far as they were allowed to go under my tuition.
Was there a social side to the RAF, the volunteer reserve?
Not really.
Volunteer?
I mean, not really, it wasn't, no.
So it wasn't, I mean, because like the army, there's terrible drinking in the evening.
That's right, no. No, there was the odd social dance or something like that, but it was few and far between.
Now, why did you leave? Because you left in 53, or was it, I mean...
That's right.
What made you decide to pack up?
Well, I'd completed my contract. And at that stage, I was informed that the defence contract was being reduced. And as a result of it, they couldn't offer me a further contract for a further period. I'd have liked to have carried on flying, but I wasn't permitted to, as with the other pilots. It was being contracted, the department, a defence programme, and therefore we were what you call casualties.
Now, what did you ever get the chance to fly again? I mean, as a pilot, I suppose.
Not really. It's only in recent years. My youngest son had qualified as a private pilot, and occasionally he used to take me up and even let me take the aircraft over. He was more than happy to relax and look around and see what was going on outside.
Now, the only other thing we've got to cover is that you do quite a lot for SAFA. Could you just explain what SAFA is and why you're so interested in it? Because you do quite a lot for SAFA.
Yes, I do, actually. I joined SAFA at the beginning of the year 2000. That was after completing my service with the Citizens Advice Bureau. And at that stage, I realised I wanted to do other voluntary work of a similar nature to the CAB. And as it got a military background, and obviously I had certain sympathy towards ex-service people, and particularly veterans.
Now, SAFA stands for?
Soldiers, Sailors, Airmen, Airmen's Family Association, / Forces Support. That is the full title, so it may seem.
Now, what is the role of SAFA?
Well, it's largely to look after the interest of ex-service people, to give them advice, guidance, and possible, tangible things which they require, like electric scooters, wheelchairs, therapeutic equipment. Sometimes they need money for if they want to visit a sick relative and haven't got any money. They might need a certain amount of renovation in their homes and they haven't got the money to pay for it. So it covers many, many things that you can help people, ex-service people, yeah.
And what do you actually do for them?
Well, I'm what they call a caseworker. There are only four of us in this area that covers Basildon, Brentwood, Billericay and the general area. And I generally cover the Billericay area. We have about 35,000 people here in Billericay, and there are quite a lot of ex-service people who need help.
Now, what kind of case? Can you give us some examples of some of the worst case or typical cases? Well, obviously maintaining their anonymity.
Confidentiality. Yep. Yes, obviously. Well, one which I thought was quite poignant. Related to a young girl soldier. She was 21, actually. She'd been a soldier since she was 16, had done very well and become a corporal, and obviously intended to be a career. But one night, during a social occasion, she was driving and had a terrible car crash, and she suffered a brain damage, and as a result, she had to leave the army, was discharged. And she was wheelchair bound, has been since that time. And she, her family in Billericay needed financial help with regard to alterations in the home that will cope with wheelchairs, widened doors. There was in the garden, certain facilities were made that were wheelchair favoured wheelchair facilities. And in actual fact, the whole thing, it cost something like £4,500. And I was able to actually get that money and to pay for everything that was required. And I felt so sorry for her being a relatively young girl who was virtually a vegetable.
Now, one of the problems is that SAFA deals with all the Second World War veterans are coming
no,
through.
Not only them. Yeah, that's true. Most of them are. But there are a lot more because SAFA, people that qualify for SAFA help is a simple basis of one day's service for one day's pay. If you have that, you're entitled to help from SAFA. As
now,
simple as that.
Isn't there a terrible pressure, though, as all those Second World War veterans come to the age where they're going to start needing this sort of, need assistance, some of them anyway. Is there a pressure on SAFA funds? How is SAFA financed?
Well, they have very little finance themselves, but what happens, you have to almanise funds from different charities and different regimental funds and the Royal Navy, the Royal Air Force Benevolent Fund. They all in turn, you can approach them with a case. You have to make the case out, obviously, to stand up. And if they've got £50,000, you couldn't look for them for charity, So it's all judged on the merits of the individual. And if it's a deserving case, in the main, I find that these service charities are very, very good.
So the caseworker assesses the case.
Quite.
Well, first defines the
case.
He
goes to their home.
Assesses it.
Them, yeah.
And then acts as a negotiator
to almanise the money. That is
a facilitator to get the money.
That
from
is
the
correct.
Various, he finds the charity.
Exactly.
And sorts it out.
That's your
so
function.
So it doesn't have much of its own money.
Very little SAFA.
Now, you do raise money for SAFA as well. If you just briefly tell us how you do that. Because
well, we have garden parties, and people do tend to bequeath money to SAFA. Many people, charity organisation, decide that they're going to have functions, and that the proceeds will be for SAFA. And this is fairly widespread, strange as it may seem. And we have enough administratively to run SAFA. That's the main thing.
And you do talks as well, don't you?
Well, I personally do, because I do talks, military ones in particular, and it's my gesture, apart from being a caseworker, to generate certain funds to help with the administration. I do that, yes.
Thank you very much.